Welcome to Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesh of Flesh and Beck Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesh and Beck Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesh and Beck Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesh.
Welcome to Legal Talk. My name is Scott Whatley. We are glad you are with us today. Our show is brought to you by Flesh and Beck Law. Glad to have Kevin Flesh in studio. Kevin, good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Scott.
Wow. Again, we've said this every week for nine, 10 months now, but I mean, boy, have you... Interesting time.
Yes.
Every angle.
I would have never thought that in the middle of March that I'd be sitting here in the fall of 2020 still talking about the same issues. And it seems like it's going to continue. We almost all of the Front Range District Courts this week and last week continued jury trials until most of them aren't going until to the middle of January. So I had a bunch of trials in December that I thought one of them I was really looking forward to going on. Doesn't look like we're going to be able to get our day in court because they can't get jurors. I mean, they can get jurors in. I think because I've done several jury trials in the last 8 weeks and talked with jurors are willing to come in the building and they're willing to serve. But I think the leadership of the courts are concerned about safety for those folks and COVID numbers spiking and all of that and being concerned about individuals getting sick because of jury service. And so they're just not doing it. And I get all of that. Right. I mean, I understand where we're at. I'm really looking forward to the vaccine hopefully coming out and hopefully having the success that they're saying that they're going to have. Because I think that hopefully will relieve a lot of the stress that everyone is under relating to this. And there's a lot of fatigue out there. I'm seeing it in opposing counsel. I'm seeing it in judges. I mean, this week I've had a bunch of court appearances where the judges are really beginning to, I think they recognize... The period of time we've been able to get a lot of things accomplished, but not as much as they need to, especially with criminal defense clients that are sitting in custody. And what do? They can't get jurors in the building. And I think especially those judges that think that maybe we would be able to do it because we've done it the last few months and that it still would be possible to get 12 or 13 people in a room spaced out 6 feet apart with masks and all of that and still be able to get the process completed in a fair manner for the defendant. But they're just not able to do it. And so it's going to be a while for us to get through this. And 2021 is going to be crazy because I know what's going to happen. All of these courts that don't have jury trials now are going to try to figure out how they're going to be able to do as many as possible once they are unleashed. And then there's going to be issues with the rest of us who have a regular practice and a regular business to take care of that maybe we're double and triple set on things and you can't try two trips.
There's
so many of me, and I can only do so many. So, and I know that my problem is not that as much as maybe the public defenders in the state or the prosecutors, depending upon the jurisdiction and what's going on there. And so, it's going to be interesting times. But we're still getting things resolved. We've settled some cases this week that I was happy to see resolved that I didn't think would resolve, but they have. And I think insurance companies are trying to do the right thing a lot of times and trying to offer monies that maybe they would have waited for a trial to happen, but they also recognize where everything is and it's at the end of the year and maybe they had some additional monies remaining from their loss ratios that they could spend. And so we've been able to get several cases done within the last few weeks that have been really beneficial for our clients.
Wow, great.
Yeah.
Once again, it's Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. And on today's segment, we're going to talk about premise liability cases and how to maximize recovery. And so I guess we'll start out kind of with defining that, Kevin, first of all. What is the premise liability law, so to speak?
Exactly. So the legislature, decades ago, put together primarily from lobbyists relating to real property owners in the state, put together a statute. So it's not so when I bring a claim for someone that's been hurt in Colorado, it's generally in two types of arenas. One is sort of the car accidents where you're saying someone was negligent, that they didn't they didn't do what a reasonable person would do in that circumstance, and they caused the accident, and that caused injuries. Well, it used to be the same sort of premise relating to real property. When someone got hurt on somebody's property, they would try to make the same argument. And what they did is they codified it. The legislature created a law called the Premises Liability Act. And the reason that it's a little bit different in the sense of real property versus, let's say, a car accident is because of the status of the person on the real property. And it makes a difference under the premises liability statute as to why you're there. So, and there's really three different types of individuals who are on your property. The first one is an invitee, someone that is there to conduct business, and the way it's defined is that someone for mutual purpose. So, and a person that comes on your property that you're doing business.
So you come here to the radio station to do an interview.
Right.
You're
so,
invited.
Yep. So it's a situation where we both have an obligation, and also we're gaining some benefit from the interaction that we're having. Well, your duty is higher in those situations because of that relationship. So the plaintiff, when I get hurt, walking in the door and falling into a big hole in the receptionist area here at the radio station. Of course, there isn't one, but if there was some sort of what's called a dangerous condition on the premises, what I have to prove because of the relationship that you and I have and the radio station has, what I have to prove is that the radio station knew or the radio station should have known under reasonable circumstances of that dangerous condition. And so my level of proof is a little bit less because I don't have to just prove that you actually knew, because sometimes that's difficult. Mm-hmm. I don't have to prove that you actually knew, but that you should have known if you were a reasonable radio station in the way that you maintain your property. And so that's the first sort of status that's important. The second one is the licensee, where I'm on your premises just because I have the ability to be there. I have permission, but there's no mutual purpose, so I'm just there. A lot of times you'll see that when, let's say, someone is walking from one place to another, and you're walking across someone's parking lot, and you're walking across that parking lot not for any mutual benefit, but just because that's the easiest path for you to get to, and I fall into a pothole in that parking lot. I then have to prove in that scenario where the relationship is a licensee, I have to prove that you knew that that pothole was there and that you didn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes is difficult. I've had a number of cases where exactly that scenario, where a person, actually the one that I can think of that's the most relevant here, is I had a client that was walking across a green space like that, and part of the landscaping, they had railroad ties in the landscaping, and one of the railroad ties, to fasten that railroad tie to the ground, they had big spikes. And there was a big spike sticking out of one side of the railroad tie, and my client stepped, I think, either through it or on it, somehow tripped, fell, and broke their ankle. And the issue was, did the people that owned that real property know that that dangerous condition was there? And in that case, what we did is we got, you know, landscaping records, we got individuals who were regularly in that area to prove that they knew about it. But if we hadn't been able to find that sort of person, we would not have been able to prove our case, and we wouldn't have proved liability. So that's the second category of individuals in premises liability. The third one is trespasser. So where you have a person that comes on your property without any permission, that knowingly does that without any sort of connection between the landowner, and then they really have very little protection relating to premises liability. In fact, there's a lot of case law and a lot of factual circumstances where individuals get gravely injured that it turns out they don't have any responsibility, the landowner doesn't have any responsibility because that trespasser was there without their permission.
Wow.
And so it does, the gradation of the relationship is important, and it's another layer of really protecting real property owners. And as many times as, you know, you hear, I think, in news reports or the media or social media about lawyers like myself that handle these cases sort of being ambulance chasers and sort of, you know, going after that claim where they shouldn't have. When you really understand what the premises liability law means and how it works, it's actually really helpful for the landowner, and especially, you know, those landowners that have retail properties, for example. We've talked about this on the other side when I'm representing individuals who own businesses that have real property that invite people in. When they do a really good job of documenting what they're doing and protecting themselves and, you know, sanding and salting the property and doing the snow removal and making sure that all of those dangerous conditions occur relating to inclement weather, if they do a good job of those things, they protect themselves from claims that I may make, because I'll get those records and say, well, they were reasonable in their efforts. And that's what it comes down to, is what a jury thinks is reasonable or not, depending upon the relationship of the person that's been hurt in comparison to the real property owner.
Right. Once again, you're listening to Legal Talk with Attorney Kevin Flesch. His number is 303-806-8886. And talking about premise liability here. So now, it seems like, and I saw something on the news last night, like where Larimer Square is up for sale.
Yeah.
Somebody may be buying it.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's take a building like this. There's not usually a Mr. Jones in Denver that owns this building. There's some place in New Jersey or California that owns the building.
Yep.
But there's management companies. So then you, as the attorney, do you, so to speak, go after the management company and the owner of the building, or how does that work?
So that's a really complicated part of a premise liability statute, because what the premise liability law says is that you can go after any landowner. And what the landowners in this particular realm of the law could be, it could be the real estate, the person that, or the entity that owns the real estate. It could also be the manager of that real property. It could also be their subs. There's a good case that would suggest that the only people you can go after is the landowner, the person that owns the real property.
Okay.
But then there's also delegation of duties that those landowners sometimes give some of the other subcontractors. And even though there's a really good case in Colorado for plaintiffs relating to the ultimate responsible party is going to be the person that owns that real property, there's also some tangential cases that would suggest that you can go after other individuals because they're still in control of the premises. And so it's really complicated in sort of a vacuum. But I'll give you an example of a case that I was working on this morning just before I came. So I've got a client that fell down in a parking lot of a King Superstore nearby in the metro area. And we're making the argument that King Supers is at fault because they're the ones that manage the, what we believe manage the parking lot.
Right.
Well, it turns out that it's not. It's another company that is a manager of the premises, and they're a real estate development company. Well, so Kroger, because that's who owns King Supers, says, well, we're not the ones that actually take care of this. Get a hold of these individuals, this real estate company, and make the demand to them. So we made the demand to them, and I talked to their company, their insurance company that handles that, this morning. And the claim rep, very nice guy from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, calls me, and he says, well, yeah, we appreciate you giving us the demand, but actually we've tendered that defense. In other words, by contract, we have a landscaping company that's supposed to be taking care of that. And that landscaping company, AAA Landscaping, whatever they were, is going to pick up the defense of that. And so he said, but I just heard from them, and they say that they have a subcontractor that actually does the snow removal. So they're going to get us the information relating to that, and that insurance company will be in contact with us. So far, I have four layers of potential defendants in this case, depending upon what I can find out factually about who's responsible, because they all could technically be landowners. And that's where individuals who have these sorts of claims really need to get a hold of us, because we need
to
get...
You don't want to do that by yourself.
We got to drill that down, because all of them... You may have a two-year statute of limitations relating to all of them, and if you knew or should have known about them as potential landowners, you may miss a statute of limitations if you don't include them in a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So this will be an interesting case to see where exactly, because everybody's pointing fingers at the other person or entity saying, well, they're under contract. They're responsible because that's what our contract says, but the law also suggests that the real property owner is the end-all, be-all. Stop to that. But you just have to see, and you have to go through that process to figure out where and who it is that is going to take responsibility in the end.
Right.
And it's not easy.
Sure.
I'll give you another example, a case that I had a few years ago in Denver where we were suing somebody, same sort of thing. It happened in a parking lot, but the parking lot was divided up into three different landowners. And part of the alley was actually the city and county of Denver property. So it really came down to us being very specific about where our client fell as to who exactly it was that was responsible for the maintenance of that facility or that parking lot. Now, they had somebody that was taking care of all of the maintenance, but we also had to get the landowner and make sure who they were. It was a very complicated case that we ended up resolving, but it was very difficult for us to get to that point because in one part of the parking lot, it was a limited liability partnership that was venued in New Jersey, just like you said, and so we had to try to track them down and figure out how do we get them served, and it was a tremendous amount of work just to get all the players in the same room to get it resolved. So
right.
That is sometimes a complexity, especially with these sorts of cases when you're dealing with who's at fault.
Sure.
Yeah.
So now let's break down the difference between premise liability and a general liability.
Yeah, so general liability, so premises liability, you've got to tie to the real property. So generally speaking, you're going to have to say that there's a dangerous condition somehow on the premises. And then what's really it comes into play with bars and restaurants, especially bars where maybe you have bouncers or you have some sort of security personnel. So there's an extra added layer of expectation of them taking care of the individuals inside who they're serving drinks to, and there's what happens with all of the other patrons inside. Sometimes you've got general liability relating to, oh, you should have protected this person, relating to what took place on the premises. At the same time, it may fall under premises liability where that lack of supervision may cause a dangerous condition on the premises, and you have a real legal issue that judges normally have to determine as to who exactly is at fault and which legal theory you can use relating to premises liability versus general liability. So let's say you and I have a contract, and you know, I'm suing you for some sort of violation of that contract. That's pretty simple. But when you get outside then of the general contract theories, you then have theories of tort that for some reason you've done something to me that you fell below the standard of care for some reason, or that you weren't reasonable in the way that you were doing things, and I may be able to bring a tort action. You know, caused me injury somehow, and it's not a contract issue, it's now a tort issue.
Right.
Those are sort of more theories of general liability that will trigger those sorts of insurance coverages sometimes. But then there's also a melding of whether or not it was a dangerous condition and whether it was a premises liability case. In some instances, we'll file a lawsuit under several different theories, and then the court is going to have to figure out which theories actually is presented to a jury down the road. And those can be pretty complicated. I had a case a few years ago where it was a car dealership that was, and it was in January or February, and so we get cold that time of year. They wash their cars on premises near the sidewalk where people walk by their dealership. Well, the water would drain out of their driveway onto that sidewalk, causing ice, so that if people walking across were to hit that ice and fall down, and I had a client, that's exactly what happened to them, and then broke their leg. So the question was, well, the real property, they actually, in the particular case that I'm talking about, didn't necessarily own the sidewalk, and it was in Denver, so sidewalk, there's no liability for injuries on sidewalks in Denver. But our argument was that they were taking the water from their real property and letting it drain across that sidewalk, creating a dangerous condition. And so the argument that we were making relating to the case is that although they weren't liable for necessarily clearing the ice and snow on right. their sidewalk, because that's not allowed, essentially you don't have a claim for that in Denver, because Denver doesn't have any municipal actual laws relating to that, but they were creating the dangerous condition on their premises, and that was draining across the situation where somebody was walking. And so it was a really interesting case. And we had briefed it. We had the court making decisions about it just before trial. We actually settled the case. We got money for our client. And then the court, just before we put the court on notice of our settlement, gave us an order. And the order in that case was that there was no liability because of the issues with the sidewalk. And they said, even though the water was draining from their premises, it didn't create a dangerous condition on that sidewalk because there is none, because there can't be a claim for that. And so we got money for our client.
Right.
Now, we didn't create any precedent necessarily because we didn't. It was in the district court level, and we didn't have to appeal that decision. Certainly, if we had not settled the case and gone to trial or had that ruling, we would have appealed and then had a court of appeals decision potentially mm-hmm. relating to it. But that was a really interesting dilemma that we've had a client that was significantly injured, but the law may not have afforded them any real ability to make a claim because liability probably couldn't have been established. But luckily, we had made enough arguments that the other side decided that they were unwilling to take that risk of what the court would do because of the significance of the injury, and we were able to resolve it.
All right. Once again, you're listening to Legal Talk. Attorney Kevin Flesh, 303-806-8886. And talking about premise liability, general liability. So let's just take our own home for a moment.
Yep.
You know, somebody's walking down your side. Now, you mentioned sidewalks.
Right.
Now, you were careful to say Denver.
Yes.
So, like, in Douglas County. Is that different?
Yeah. So if each it all depends on the municipality and the county and whether they have HOA rules, for example.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So a lot of homeowners associations have specific rules about how long you have to clear.
Yeah, shovel the snow. Yeah.
Make sure that it's clear and then make sure that it's in good sort of safe passageway for individuals who may be using it. If you have a situation where you're in a neighborhood where you have those sorts of rules and you don't clear your ice and snow, you may be liable for injury relating to that fall.
Would that go in your homeowner's insurance?
Yeah, it would.
Take care of that?
It would.
Okay.
And for those, we've had a number of claims against HOAs where the homeowners association is responsible for clearing those things. Where, you know, you've got townhomes or condos or apartments. We handle lots of those sorts of claims where we can prove that the association has a duty to clear, and they have a, just like any other landowner, and when they don't do that, they probably have somebody, a landscape company or somebody else that comes out and does that work for them, but where that individual or entity falls down and doesn't do it in a manner that's reasonable, then they're going to be liable. And what I can tell folks relating to these cases is anymore, the way we win these cases is with people taking pictures right after they fall, showing what the premises look like.
Right.
And that are date stamped, and they have GPS coordinates, and they know exactly where it's at. It's more difficult now with witnesses being called to say, yeah, this is what it looked like or didn't look like,
right,
because of the lack of reasonable efforts in maintaining those premises.
Yeah. Well, let's get into some maybe do's and don'ts then real
yeah.
quick, okay? So if you find yourself in one of these deals, you know, premise liability, you know, you get hurt, you slip and fall, and there's so many things here. I wish we had a ton of time, but we're talking about the general liability too. I mean, that falls under animal and dog bites,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Slip and falls, of course, dangerous property, negligent or inadequate security, swimming pool injuries, inadequate maintenance, children on property, retail store liability, restaurant liability. So, I mean, we could do several hours on this.
Yeah.
So, what are just some, let's take that slip and fall thing. I mean, what are just some do's and don'ts? That,
yeah, know? Other than the animal bites, they're all generally what happens is someone is somewhere where there's something on the premises. Normally, something in the walkway is either there's a maintenance issue in the sense of there's a hole or there's something that causes you to trip, or water, or some other substances, and it happens all the time. And the biggest thing for people to remember is, down the road, you have to prove to a claim rep what it was that you fell in, that it wasn't just you tripping, because we, mm-hmm. you know, especially in Colorado, we still have the majority of the folks that I talk to as jurors, they still give you some responsibility for walking through
sure.
things. So, you know, the things that are really important is a picture showing no, you know, that there was something on the floor, that there was no notice that there was some dangerous condition coming up so that you were aware of it and you tried to go around it, or that you have the ability to show that the premises, they don't do anything on a regular basis to check their real property to make sure that there's nothing going on there. And the best thing to do is show what it was when you fell so that a juror can understand, okay, this is what it looked like. Well, I wouldn't want it to look like that, is generally their response, especially with ice and snow. Or if you're in a retail establishment, you know, you've got a big puddle of water, you've got something that's draining from a freezer nearby that the retail establishment should know about. Restaurants, the same thing. Coming out of the kitchen, you have spills,
yep.
you know, whatever. people know that a restaurant should be aware of that and should take care of it, not only for their employees, but for those that they're serving. And so those pictures are really helpful. The second thing you need to do is make a claim as quickly as possible with the management of the establishment, so that a lot of times they have video of areas, especially the big box stores, the grocery stores, all of those sorts of things. And where you have a valid claim, those videos are really important because it shows what happened, and it can show a claim rep, this person isn't making it up, because that's, you know, a lot of times they'll be cynical in that way. But the videos help show people are just doing what they need to do, and there's nothing that would indicate that they should be aware of any dangerous condition. And if we can prove those things in a video or a picture right away, it makes it a lot easier to get the case resolved.
Right. And I'm sure this is much like, excuse me, when we talk about our auto accidents, sometimes you don't know you're hurt.
Yep.
And especially when you fall. I can't think of any other time you fit this. What do you want to do? You want to bounce up?
Yep.
And say, I'm fine.
You, absolutely.
Be careful doing that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And most people get so embarrassed, and a lot of times they fall into something that makes them all wet, because they're normally falling on their behind or their back, or and they're just, they don't know what it is, and it's an uncomfortable situation. And all people want to do is run out of the store. Right. And that's the last thing you really want to do. You want to make sure that you're documenting what's happened and that people get a good understanding of what took place, any witnesses that are there. And then most people, you know, say you don't have to go by ambulance unless you're really hurt, but get to a doctor right away so that they can document what exactly has happened.
Right. And we always say this, it's a free consultation with Kevin, so no matter what your legal issue may be, it is always a free consultation with Flesh and Beck Law. Their number, 303-806-8886. You can check out their website, fleshlawfirm.com. That's F-L-E-S-C-H lawfirm.com. And 1 minute, Kevin, but real quick on the dog bite issue.
Yes.
We're both dog lovers. We go to Cabela's, Bass Pro,
yep,
stuff. Do dog owners take a chance every time they take their pet into a store of possibly getting sued?
Absolutely. And the reason is because you don't know how that dog is going to react to that sort of environment. And the dogs, generally speaking, are going to either protect themselves or protect their owners. And when you're coming around those aisles that dogs just aren't used to, they're going to react sometimes to the little kid that's running around not doing anything, and the dog doesn't mean to. But if you have any aggression in a dog, and most hunting dogs or other, you just don't know how they're going to react to that situation where they get agitated and they don't know exactly what's going on. And I've seen it time and time again in our practice. I just don't suggest that people do it unless the dog is muzzled, and most people don't want to do that.
Sure.
Leave the dog in the car. Leave the dog at home. They just don't need to be in those situations, because you really can cause. Yeah. So what happens is the dog bites someone. The plaintiff's lawyer is going to go after the establishment, but they're also going to go after the dog owner, because there's two types of statutes in Colorado about that, and the dog owner is going to be the ultimate responsible party.
Right.
So you want to be careful of what you're doing with that. And I understand we want our dogs along,
sure,
and it's a nice deal, and it's always fun. But there's some real liability that can be caused by an animal in the split second.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, always good information. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Legal Talk, 303-806-8886, Flesh and Beck Law. We'll be right back.
Rates are like a roller coaster lately. Are you concerned about the future and how to protect your home? Do you want to become mortgage safe? Take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage. With home values still at their highest level ever and rates at historic lows, now may be the best time to be prepared if the economy changes. Last time, many of our friends lost their home when it was unnecessary. Take AIM, 720-895-0500. Many of our clients have the ability to tap their equity should the economy change, all without having to borrow the money now. We can show you how to access your equity in these uncertain times to give you peace of mind and allow you to focus on what's important, your family. Call Affordable Interest Mortgage at 720-895-0500. That's 720-895-0500. We are locally owned and operated since 2001. Our reputation of putting you first with straight answers and listening are unmatched in Colorado. Let us help you protect your home. Take AIM, 720-895-0500, where it's all about you.
Hi, this is Scott Watley from my friends at Enchanted Kitchens. At Enchanted Kitchens, it's all about the magic of design. Whether you're remodeling your kitchen or building a custom home, Enchanted Kitchens offers a full-service design center with multiple product lines to meet any budget. And right now, when you mention Haystack Help Radio, you'll receive 15% off your Europa brand cabinets. And after you visit their Experience Center in Inglewood, you'll get a no-cost, no-obligation in-home design consultation. Hey, after all, the kitchen is the heart of every home. Call Enchanted Kitchens today, 303-376-7588. That's 303-376-7588. Enchanted Kitchens is a member of the Haystack Help Home Team.
Rush to Reason with John Rush, weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesh of Flesh and Beck Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesh and Beck Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesh and Beck Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesh.
Welcome back to Legal Talk. My name is Scott Whatley. Again, Kevin Flesh is with us. It is Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. Trial tested, trial ready is a slogan at Flesh and Beck Law. Handle a lot of different arrays of areas, I guess I should say, of the legal area of personal injury, criminal law. And today we're going to be talking about the criminal side with Kevin. And first of all, Kevin, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's talk about misdemeanors. And, you know, I love these last few shows we've done. We've kind of talked about the court system and education for everybody. And we always hear terms of, you know, this class of felony or this type of misdemeanor. And so we just want to kind of break down misdemeanors a little bit. But before I want to get to that, we were just talking here during the break of pleas, because that's a big part of the criminal law side, isn't it?
When
someone gets convicted of something, you try to help them out.
Right. So you start out with the initial charge, and that's never something that's guaranteed that's what you're going to end up with. And people get really freaked out, I think, what a legal term, but that's what they do. They get really anxious about, because what happens, generally speaking, is people get charged with a crime, especially in the case where someone has never been charged with a crime before. They may get a summons, or they are taken in to custody and get bonded out, and then they have their next appearance is what a lot of times is either an advisement or arraignment, where the court tells you the worst case scenario, right? And the worst case scenario is always a bunch of jail time or penitentiary or huge fines or, you know, those sorts of things. And people immediately are like, wow, this is serious. I got to get a lawyer, especially when the person has no prior criminal involvement with the criminal system. And so the first thing people should know that are listening is there's almost always the ability to negotiate any case, no matter what it is. We've seen it even in the most horrific situations. Mm-hmm. You know, the shooter at the movie theater in Aurora, the public defender was always willing to plead that case down to life in prison, and that's what should have happened, because that's what ended up being the jury verdict in that case. But there was a situation where the district attorney was saying, no, we want life, and we want the death penalty. We want to go through that brain damage to make that happen. But even in that case, there was serious discussions early on. Would it be just better to resolve the case with that sort of stipulation and save everybody all of the heartache? We know how that turned out. But that's the extreme. The other extreme is just the opposite, where you have a situation where you're charged with a 4-point speeding ticket for going, you know, 10 or 15 miles an hour over on I-25. And even that is, depending upon your driving history, can be resolved very quickly, a lot of times with the back of the ticket giving you a deal, or going in and talking with the prosecutor and explaining what's going on, or doing some sort of class, or, you know, doing something, community service, to get it reduced so that you don't have those points. And so it's the same thing from that minuscule traffic ticket to the worst crime. And that's the business that we're in. And the reason that we do the sort of work we do is because we will go to trial. And, mm-hmm. and that's why the two practice areas work so well, the personal injury cases and then the criminal defense cases, because it's trial work. And it's generally the same judges that we see. Misdemeanor cases. So misdemeanors are those cases that you're only looking at a potential county jail sentence, and generally speaking up to a year or maybe two maximum. And it's not penitentiary. It's not losing your constitutional rights relating to voting, those sorts of things.
Okay.
And certainly misdemeanors, you can have the domestic violence category of misdemeanors where you lose your right to possess a firearm.
Right.
But most of the time, it's less significant. And those cases, there's more bargaining that can be done relating to options that the court has in regards to resolving it through deferred judgment or diversions or some sort of probation, community service, you know, fines, those sorts of things rather than jail time. Mm-hmm. And especially in the environment we're in now, with COVID, the judges are balancing, especially in these lower level criminal cases, they're balancing their concern about your safety and being in a jail, because COVID has been pretty rampant in the jails, versus the punitive sanction, what it's going to teach you, versus hurting you long term because you'd get COVID and have responsibility. You know, you'll just have issues the rest of your life with it potentially. And so what we're seeing a lot with those sorts of things is in-home detention or more community service, or there's other sort of aspects of a sentence that are more creative than just throwing you in jail for 30 days and letting you, you know, come out. And our legislature has taken the tact that, and especially these misdemeanors and crimes that are of less significance, they're really looking at rehabilitative things to have you maybe learn some life skills so that you don't do that again, especially in the arena of DUIs and that sort of thing.
Gotcha. So, you know, you think about job applications, a lot of times they'll ask you, you know, and I don't know what the term is today on them, you know, have you been arrested?
Correct.
Or anything
or
like that?
Or convicted.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, first of all, I guess, can they ask that
yes.
on an employment application?
They can. They generally can ask about any arrests and any convictions relating to felonies. They sometimes will ask for, depending upon what you're doing for work, like if you're applying for to be a lawyer or some other type of licensure, they get to look into all of your criminal history.
Sure.
But other aspects of employment, maybe not. But they'll ask if you've had been arrested for anything. And, you know, the CBI, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, you and I can go, as long as I have the person's name and date of birth, I can go get a records check on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's $6.85, and you can go to CBI and do that whenever you'd like, and it's public information. The sometimes the trouble with CBI is there are some jurisdictions that may not report certain things. You get a deferred judgment, so there's not an actual conviction that's entered against you relating to a criminal case. That sort of procedure won't show up on your criminal background check because it's not an actual conviction. Or if you've been convicted of something, especially misdemeanors now, with the way that the sealing statute has been modified, let's say you had a criminal mischief charge, misdemeanor 10 years ago,
right,
that was an actual conviction. Within the last 3 years, the sealing statute has changed so that most likely, unless it's domestic violence related, you're able to seal that so that it comes off your criminal history. So, and once it's sealed, you're able to say on those applications that it never happened, as if it never happened. But those are things that we certainly help people with, because the sealing statute has changed. It used to be that if you had a state court misdemeanor conviction, you couldn't seal that. Now with the change in the legislature and the way that they've manipulated the sealing statute, let's say you had a misdemeanor theft conviction from 10 or 15 years ago and you completed probation successfully, that's now a conviction that you'd be able to get sealed and have it taken off of your record. And it even applies to felonies, to class 6, 5, and 4 felonies,
okay,
depending upon what it is, the crime. But if it's not domestic violence, if it's not any sort of sex-related,
mm-hmm,
most likely all of those other, certainly drug-related crimes, or any other crime relating to theft or those sorts of things that are in those category of felonies, after a period of time, you've got to complete the probation successfully and wait a period of time with no further violations of the law. But if you've done all of those things, you can seal the record.
Sure.
And we're helping people with those on a pretty regular basis now.
Is that just kind of a flat fee thing, or does that depend on each deal, or how does that work?
It's generally a flat fee. Well, there's a filing fee for it, and then we have a bunch of work that we have to do relating to sending out certified mail to all these different entities that have the ability to object, and then we have a hearing. And so it's a flat fee related to that work.
Oh, okay.
And it's something that's it's actually pretty complicated for the average individual to do on their own.
Yes.
So
I want to do that.
Right. So sometimes I'll have a person that'll call that seems pretty sophisticated, and they've looked at the internet and they've kind of looked at the statute and said, these are the things that I need to do, I think. And I say, yeah, that's right. And you have to do it in a certain way, in a certain manner. And then you get a hearing and you have to go through all of this process. And I say, well, this is what we charge. And they're like, oh, okay. And they'll say, well, that's a lot of money right now. I'm going to go try to do it on my own. And the majority of those people, even though they are sophisticated and they are able to do it on their own, come back 45 days later when they haven't done everything properly and the court has denied their application, said, oh, okay, now I understand the value and what you guys are doing, and will you handle this for us? And we do, and we take care of it. And so, and especially with the way the statute has changed over the last 18 months, there's a lot more cases that are now you can seal versus what it used to be. You know, I've talked previously on shows with the fact that the misdemeanor domestic violence cases, if you were charged and convicted in municipal courts, those were sealable and you were able to get those off your record pretty quickly after completing whatever you needed to do for probation. Now that's not the case. They've cleaned up that aspect of the statute, so you're not able to do it. But you have a lot more other options if you have other convictions.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and it's a super interesting part of the process because it used to be that the way we would advise clients relating to these convictions for some of these misdemeanors, especially theft and shoplifting, there's a real negative connotation relating to those in our society, understandably so. A lot of those can be now cleaned up and you can get some of the majority of them off of your record as long as you don't have any new violations over a period of time, depending upon whether it's a misdemeanor or felony. Mm-hmm. And people have to remember that that's a big deal. The misdemeanor versus felony, there are certain things that happen when you get convicted of a felony because you lose a lot of your constitutional rights because of that conviction. And most people don't realize that when they're taking some sort of plea, and they need to understand what they're really doing. I had a case this morning that I was talking to a woman that just took a plea in a case, and she was saying, well, and it was a case where she had taken some drugs into a Department of Corrections facility for her spouse that was now in custody. And, of course, it was an interesting conversation because she had no criminal history before that as to why she thought that that was a good idea. But she took a plea with the public defender, and it sounded like an appropriate plea. But at the same time with that plea, one of the conditions is she can't have conversations or she can't have contact with her husband while she's on probation for 18 months. And she said, well, that's not fair. I said, you're absolutely right, it's not fair. But it's a condition now that you've agreed to as a part of your plea bargain. And those are the sorts of things you have to think about, not today, not next week, but a year from now when you really want to have contact with him. And you can't, because if you do, in this particular case relating to the Department of Corrections, all of those phone calls are recorded. It's not like, she goes, well, my kids can talk to him. I said, sure, but as soon as you get on the line, when your kids are on there, it's recorded. It's going to be very easy for them to hear it. And you may be sitting in that facility with him. I mean, you don't want to get yourself in those situations. And so that's why we always talk about these cases and the fact that people need to really think about what they're doing.
Yep.
Many people think they can self-help, sort of take care of it on their own, especially in the DUI arena, on first DUIs. They're like, ah, we don't need you. It's not that complicated. It's not a big deal, and we'll take care of it. And they do. And then 2 years later, when they haven't taken care of sort of their own life, and they get a second one, and now they're in real danger. And we look back on the first one, and they had some real defenses to the first case. And we talk about those defenses and what they should have done differently. It's always one of those things where I'd rather talk to somebody early on because we're free consultations.
Yeah, I mean, what do you have to lose?
Right.
I mean, you do have a lot to lose. When I say, what do you have to lose?
This is the conversation that I generally have people when they get charged. We have a conversation about what it is they need to be concerned about and why it's important to have a lawyer. And I don't do that to sort of be... in a situation where I'm trying to tell them what to do like I'm all-knowing. I'm just saying, listen, this, it's much like any other problem that you have in your life. You're going to want to get somebody, whether it's me or somebody else, because there's lots of criminal defense lawyers out there, you want to get somebody that really knows what they're doing to resolve it for you so that you understand your options. Because a lot of what we do is giving people options so that they understand the whole gamut of what they can do.
Right.
And we've done it long enough relating to the criminal cases is that the other thing we do is we get to know the personality of the prosecutors and what cases that we can really deal with and what cases we can't, and get creative in how we resolve things. Because in the environment we're in right now, I don't get to go into somebody's office like
sure.
I used to and sit down across from the table from them. It's over Zoom, it's over WebEx, it's over Teams.
And that changes the dynamic of a conversation.
It really does. It does. And what it does is it also changes the dynamic in how you approach the case sometimes, because sometimes you have to get that prosecutor in a position where they think they're going to be going to trial before they really are willing to start talking to you about resolving the case. Well, in our current environment where jury trials aren't going on until the middle to end of January, the prosecutor, other than just the natural volume of what they have in their office, has no real interest in resolving the case until they get into a position where they're not in control.
Right.
And so unless they know that the lawyer, you have a relationship with the lawyer, because sometimes, and right now in particular, I have relationships with these lawyers because I see them on a regular basis. They know that we're still handling a lot of criminal defense work, and they know that eventually when jury trials happen, we'll be trying cases again. So they'd rather have that conversation early on, because maybe this is a case that they can get resolved depending upon what the facts are, and depending upon what my sort of level of interest is in resolving the case or going to trial.
Right.
And that's just experience.
Sure.
You know, and it's just knowing people in the system and having them understand where you're going with the case.
Right. Once again, you're listening to Legal Talk. Attorney Kevin Flesh, Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. And as Kevin mentioned, it is always a free consultation. So let's break down misdemeanors. Are there numbers associated with those? Are they letters, classes?
Yeah.
I mean, how many...
There are
different types.
And it's counterintuitive. So misdemeanors, there's three classes of misdemeanors. It goes from one to three. I always think class one misdemeanor would be the least because it's the smallest number, but it's actually just the opposite.
Okay.
It's the most significant misdemeanor you can be charged with. Class one misdemeanors include, you know, third degree assaults, DUI cases, all of those things where they can put you in the county jail for a year or two, depending upon whether it's what's called an extraordinary risk crime or not, even in misdemeanors. But so they go from one to three, and they all have a potential of some sort of county jail time, no penitentiary time. And that is generally the majority of the cases that we see. It's the majority of the cases, so they're serious, but they're not significant injury. There's not significant real consequences except for where you're talking about, let's say, a third DUI. That's still a class one misdemeanor, but the sentencing range is more significant because of the lifetime amount of DUIs that the person has had and the fact that the legislature has said there's some mandatory jail time as it relates to those individuals because of their risk on the road, which makes complete sense.
Sure.
I mean, it really does. And those individuals, a first-time DUI offender, generally it's a mistake. When you get to the second, you know you've got some issues with the person with alcohol and decision-making. And if you can't get it resolved and they have a third, then the third is always a dividing line between sort of the career drinkers and not. Hopefully the person by that time has figured out that they have a lifelong problem with drugs or alcohol and they can't be driving, period. And if not, they've got to figure out their sobriety, how they deal with those sorts of aspects in their life and what they're going to do about it. And I have a lot of conversations with people anymore. Before we even get to sort of the defense of the action and what happened to them and being arrested and all of that, we have a real good conversation. And I enjoy this aspect of my practice of talking to the people about why they got themselves into the situation, whether they have multiple driving under the influence charges, because it's always an indicator that something else is going on in their life and how exactly they're going to deal with it.
And then a few years ago, didn't they change that as far as number of DUIs and a felony?
Fourth or more, the prosecutor has the discretion of filing for felony charges. And certainly, I just finished a sentencing on a client this week that had his fifth conviction, and we were able to keep. He was charged with the class four felony. So we talked about misdemeanors. Felonies go from one to six. Same sort of deal. You'd think the one would be the least because it's the lowest number. It's just the opposite. It's those are the murder cases, all the way down to F6s, which are, you know. Violation of, let's say, a pawnbroker, if you lie to a pawnbroker, or if you have theft at a lower level theft that's not a misdemeanor theft, but it's enough to cause you to be charged with a felony, those sorts of things. So one to six for felonies. Well, a DUI where you have four or more convictions, actually it would be the fourth or more, can be charged as a felony. That's a class four felony. So could be 2 to 4 years, 2 to 6 years, depending upon the circumstance and Department of Corrections, for what generally people think of as sort of a misdemeanor charge.
Right, right.
But because you have so many, the legislature, again, has made a determination that you could be charged with a felony and go to prison for it. I don't care what your belief about it is, that's a big decision for a person in those sorts of circumstances in stopping their activities with regard to drinking and driving. And I think it has made an effect on those individuals that have a real issue. But yeah, so that you can get yourself into a situation where what you think is a misdemeanor, and what happens a lot of times is those cases start out as misdemeanors. The prosecutors recognize the history once they get it of the person that's involved, and then they dismiss the misdemeanor and file for the felony charges. And there's just more real danger for the person to go away for a long period of time.
And, as you look back, did you see any change really once that law came out much or not really?
I haven't from the fact of what people are doing in regards to their drinking and driving behavior, I haven't seen that much of a change, which you'd think you would. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there's been studies that will suggest that there is some change.
Right.
In our practice, I haven't seen as much of it. I know that the individuals that we represent that get themselves into that situation recognize early on that they have significant concern about going away. It's one thing to go to a county court and a county jail sentence for a DUI. It's another when you're talking about, you know, going to a penitentiary. Mm-hmm. Because most people that are in that situation otherwise are law-abiding. You know, they a lot of times have jobs. They're leading a regular life, but they've got this aspect of their life that's out of control. And when you start talking about taking away all of the other aspects of their life because of this one thing, that's when they really have the conversation, I'd say probably 25% of the time, where they begin to realize that this is not manageable for them anymore and they've got to go do something about it. Otherwise, the system is going to take care of them. They're just going to put them away, make sure that they're not causing any more harm to society, and then hopefully giving them a real wake-up call about what they have to do to get themselves straight.
Right. In DUIs, and we'll probably do a show on one of those, that topic here coming up, the holidays and all, but they stay on. If you get one when you're 20, one when you're 40, one when you're 60, they stay on forever,
they
right?
They do. I just finished one with the fellow that is in his late 60s that had a case 50, it was almost 50 years ago he had his first, and it's still there in another state, and they find them.
Oh, even in another state?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. It's lifetime, and it's no matter what state. You have to, so when you go in, let's say you take a plea, and I, as an officer of the court, have to ask you and be certain about whether or not you're telling me the truth, because As an officer of the court, I have to be upfront with the court as to how many you have. And if I don't know, I also have to tell the court about that. And certainly probation does its own searches. Mm-hmm. But I've had a number of situations in the past 5 or 10 years where the individual did not tell us about a case in another state and they found it. And so we took a plea, let's say, to a second, and they had one in another state that was a third. That plea comes back, and then the prosecutor generally doesn't offer the same thing, and it puts them in a difficult spot. So I always have that conversation with clients when they first come in. And in fact, I had a client recently that didn't retain me because he told me all of the ones that he had, and I told him I have to disclose those to the court. And he says, well, I'm not going to do that because I think I can get away with it. And he was going to go represent himself and take his chances. And that's just not a good place to be, but that's what he decided. And I was upfront with him. Listen, I have to make sure the prosecutor is aware of all of these. And I know you want me to move forward in a different way, but ethically I can't do it. And so I said, I can't represent you. It wouldn't be fair to you, and I certainly ethically can't do it with the court because I would be doing you a disservice at this point, one that you probably should own up to anyway. But if you want to take another avenue on trying to take your chances on it, then you need to go represent yourself.
Right.
Because you're not going to find anybody else in the state that most likely will do it the way you want it to be done. And probably gave him a little bit more information about something. He'll probably find a younger lawyer that won't do their due diligence, and he won't be honest with them and cause them some heartache. But we'll just see where that goes and what he does with it down the road.
Sure. Now, out of all these things we've talked about, what really can keep you from owning a gun? We do our Sportsman of Colorado show together. And
absolutely.
We talk about guns a lot. And a lot of people don't realize, man, when you get that domestic violence.
The domestic violence.
It's huge.
It is a gigantic stop for people being able to have a gun. And that's the other thing is that we've talked about this on other shows too. You can go get a hunting license. You can go, and there's no way that CPW checks to see whether or not you can lawfully carry a gun in Colorado when they give you that hunting license. And it's very clear that if you have a domestic violence conviction, you can't own a gun. You can't possess it. Now, there are things you can do about that depending upon the circumstance and depending upon what that conviction is. We just have to have a conversation about it. But that's the first one. The second one is certainly felonies. You can't, again, possess a gun when you are a felon, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And there's no way you can get around that. I've got one right now where it's actually going to be an interesting case and sort of a case study of what exactly a gun is, because there's some black powder rifles and things that are out there. They're kits that you can go out and buy and put together that you don't need to go through any sort of, a CBI to check whether or not you're able to buy a gun and do that check. I've got one right now where the guy did that and had it in his possession, and it's whether or not at the time that he had it, first of all, was it a gun under the statute, and second of all, was it capable of firing because of the caps and everything that's needed. So I'm litigating that case right now, and that is going to be an interesting question. But listening to the radio and what is the answer? The answer is if there's anything that you have in your possession that can create a situation where it emits a projectile out of a barrel,
right. That's
probably a gun, and you can't have it. And it's the same thing with bow and arrow. It's the same thing with crossbows. All of those things are not capable. You just can't possess them in Colorado, even though you can have a valid hunting license. The problem is the other aspect is in hunting, you have to own most likely a gun or possess a gun. And you're not able to do it when you have domestic violence or a felony.
And you know what? No matter what we've talked about today, misdemeanors, felonies, whatever, you still have rights.
You do.
And
you got a bunch.
That's what you're about.
Yeah.
It's just making sure people's rights are respected.
That's exactly right. I mean, the system is so large, and there are so many resources for the state to prosecute people. Where what I am is I'm your help. I'm your shield, making sure that the system, number one, is fair, and number two, understanding that they have all of the burden. They have all the responsibility to prove what they're saying you did happened and that you committed some sort of crime. And during that process, 97% of the time, 95% of the time, we're able to get the cases resolved either through something that the client is willing to accept in the way of responsibility or get the cases dismissed.
Gotcha.
Before going to trial. And we love trying cases, don't
sure.
get me wrong, but there's always things you can do. And the darkest day for a lot of people is when they get charged and they're sitting in a jail sentence cell and they're going to get bonded out and they're like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. There's still lots that can be done even in those darkest situations. So we help people see the light a little bit, work through them, really talk about step by step what we're going to do, and then figure out a way to make it happen for them.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, the best thing you can do if you find yourself in that situation is call 303-806-8886. It is Flesh and Beck Law. fleshlawfirm.com. Give Kevin a call and his team will be ready to help you. So Kevin, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us on Legal Talk. Hope you have a great rest of your day.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.